like a Hellcat.
Hello and welcome back to The Ink Drop. My name is Matthew McGevna and this is the fourth installment of my little mini-series on John Gardner's On Moral Fiction, coming at you live from a remote location, an undisclosed location in Florida. If you happen to hear all sorts of noises coming from outside or a knock at the door, or occasional yelp, it's my children who can't get to sleep because we're heading off to Disney. So forgive me if there's any background noise right now. I think we're in pretty good shape, though. If you haven't listened to the first three episodes, you're free to go back and listen to those. Go ahead and pause this, because we're going to be just dealing with this chapter four of John Gardner's On Moral Fiction. In previous chapters, he lays out what he considers to be the parameters of the word moral, and he also lays out pretty clearly the role of the artist and the role of the critic when it comes to moral art. This episode, we're going to be looking at chapter four of part one of the book, Premises on Art and Morality, where Gardner finally does start to get into some specifics. So in the first three chapters, you would notice if you have been reading the book that he speaks in a little bit more generalities. Now he starts to actually use some of the fables and some of the stories that we all grew up with and that we're familiar with to sort of lay out his case for moral fiction, what makes fiction moral, what makes art moral in general. So here's where we start to see Gardner get into some real specifics. He takes some time in the book, as you'll notice, to talk about theater and music, and a lot of it would require me to really pore over classical music that was written in the 1970s and perusing the playbills of Broadway shows from the 70s. As much as the book, you know, this particular book does have some degree of universality to it, I think it does in a lot of ways apply even to artists writing in the 2020s. It is essentially a contemporary book, contemporary for his time. Gardner is reacting to the art and literature of his time that he wrote this. But he does pull some timeless intuition out of the examples that he gives, but there's a fair amount of pages where he talks quite a bit about the theater of the 1970s and what was going on in the various concert halls in the 1970s. John Gardner was a bit of an expert on opera. He had written a couple of arias of his own, so he was somewhat of an opera buff and a classical music buff, as well as someone who was really interested in the visual arts as well, so he was very tuned into what was going on in art galleries at that time period. So there are some references, vague references, and somewhat semi-specific references in the book to some artists, but he doesn't always name them, so sometimes it kind of causes you to scratch your head. I had to do a bit of research on to, you know, who it was in the 1970s that was, for example, exploding pianos, because he talks quite a bit later on in the book about the sort of pretentiousness of exploding pianos, and he talks a little bit about John Cage, who I didn't know who John Cage was, but apparently was a sort of an experimental composer who played on the idea of composing an orchestra with silence. So in other words, he would assemble the musicians on the stage and they wouldn't actually play any of their instruments. They would just sit for 4 minutes and 33 seconds of total silence to try to make some sort of larger point about music. So there was a lot of that kind of going on, that kind of avant-garde movement, the kind of avant-garde experimental literature, experimental music, and John Gardner was talking about it quite a bit. And I'm not quite sure what references were realistic references that he pulled right out of the pages of the New York Times, and how much he just, and what were just ideas that or scenarios that he had kind of dreamed up in his own head. I couldn't find so much about the exploding pianos, but there is some evidence that there might have been some musicians out there playing with the idea of assembling an audience to listen, presumably to some piano concertos, and then just blowing up the pianos in front of the audience. But needless to say, apparently in the 1970s, there was a lot of conversation in intellectual and literary circles about what to do with the artists who were too young to include in the modern movement, right? Meaning Hemingway, Faulkner, Joyce, T.S. Eliot, Gertrude Stein, Ezra Pound, the modernists as we know them. They were too young to be part of that movement. Those people that I mentioned, Faulkner, Joyce, Hemingway, they were pioneers of what we would call that modernist movement. Well, what does it mean? It came out of the war, at least from what I always understood it. Came out of the war, a consequence of the war. Human beings at that point had experienced destruction and death, the likes of which there had been no comparison, really, at that point. And so the world had changed virtually overnight, because warfare, as it was known all the years prior, all the centuries prior, had been done on horseback with swords and hand-to-hand. And believe it or not, even though a lot of times our films show just hundreds and thousands of people just cutting each other to ribbons with swords, it was actually quite a bit more intimate and quite a bit more brutal than that. And casualties were actually much lower. On a typical battlefield sometimes, maybe no more than a dozen or two dozen people would actually be killed on the battlefield before the battle would be called and one side would retreat. When you have hand-to-hand combat, that's kind of just how it is. It's not always how it's laid out in, you know, in Braveheart or Gladiator. But World War I changed that. You had people literally dropping bombs out of airplanes, right, out of machines that flew into the air above your head. You had trench warfare. You had machine guns, gas warfare. So the world had really changed overnight. Human beings had experienced destruction and chaos and brutality that they couldn't really compare to anything except for maybe the biblical scriptures. So trusted institutions, belief in human goodness, all of those had been sort of thrown out the window, right? These trusted realities were no longer trusted. So the modernists set about reinventing things. They said, well, we can't really trust the institutions. We can't trust the language even. We can't trust the structures, the infrastructure that has built our reality, has supported our reality up to this point, because World War I completely blew all of that to smithereens. The modernists went about and started to reinvent things. Language, for starters, right? The job of narration when it came to a story. Then later, our what would you call them, pre-painted notions of what things looked like. A cloud, heaven, hell, the devil, God, justice. How we tell our stories, all of that was challenged and made new. In fact, that was T.S. Eliot's charge, was make it new. How are you going to make this new? You know, so we all kind of know what hell is. It's this fiery place of torment, and there's a devil, and he's a pitchfork. But how can we reinvent, how can you recreate what hell looks like in order to make it new? Okay, so that was the modernists. And what grew from that are the postmodernists. And the best I can do, a really dumbed down explanation of postmodernism, because I can hardly understand it myself, so I can really only offer a dumbed down explanation. Postmodernism took what the modernists did and moved it further down the road. All of it needed to go and needed to be reinvented. Right. Well, our notions of right and wrong, good and evil, institutions such as marriage, education, economic systems. It was all a social construct anyway, right? So let's tear it all down and see what's behind it. And for many of these writers, they discovered that, well, nothing was behind it. And so a sort of meaningless nihilism rose up to take the place of what they had torn down. Does that sound right? I don't know. I think that's the crux of it, right? All the things that we've come to accept in our society are all constructs of our society, and therefore, if you were to tear it all down, you would have very little that would resemble some sort of universal reality that exists outside of ourselves. That if you tore it all down, you'd realize that you can actually rebuild it yourself, right? I don't know if I did that any justice, but that seems like what Gardner is responding to in this book is the rise of nihilism in literature. The rise of nihilism as a consequence of postmodernism, the attempt to sort of look at everything as kind of a silly game, a social constructed game. So this rise of nihilism takes place in literature, and then by virtue of that, the rise of what he considers immoral art. So, okay, in the 70s, though, postmodernism was hip, right? It was cool. And many of the critics of this time are writing for those Kingmaker publications, right? The New York Review of Books, the LA Times, the New York Times, the New Yorker. They started to categorize and separate writers of fiction into, you know, what is postmodern and what is not postmodern. And what was deemed postmodern was genius, was deemed genius. They enshrined artists they considered postmodern as the new pride of literary lions. But postmodernism is really just stylistic choice, is what John Gardner says, right? Excuse me. It's really just stylistic choice. Turns of phrase, points of view, new and fresh metaphors. These were just style choices. And the critics fell for this window dressing, right, is what Gardner is saying here in this chapter. The critics kind of fell for it. They said, well, let's divide what's postmodern, what's not postmodern, and then we're going to kind of hail the postmodernists as this new wave of geniuses. But they were really just falling for style, right? They were falling for that window dressing. They focused almost entirely on style choices. So what ended up happening is that when critics placed an undue value on style and approach at the expense of what serious questions are being asked about life, the new pride of literary lions placed an undue value on style and approach. So it became sort of a cycle that ate itself. The critics were looking at style and approach. The writers knew that the critics were focusing in and honing in on their style and approach, and so they focused even more unnecessarily on style and approach. In other words, they said nothing, but they said it beautifully. Okay, now Gardner says in this chapter, what ends up happening is that the artist dresses up his art with style and then just uses characters and setting and plot to deliver what he calls in the book, well-intentioned propaganda. Now, that's interesting, right? So it's on page 60, right, where he talks about this. On page 60, he says, the subversion of art to the purposes of propaganda leads inevitably to one or the other of the two common mistakes in bad art. Overemphasis on texture, on the one hand, and manipulative structure on the other, where characters are stick figures, cartoons of good and evil, and where plot is kept minimal and controlled by message, not by the developing will of lifelike human beings. The playwright has nothing at his disposal but the set and his characters' talk, his caricatures' talk. Hence the bombast of a play like Baraka's Dutchman or Ed Bullins' push toward the ultimate textural surprise, the murder of a member of the audience. Even our best, or at least most serious playwrights, lean excessively on the methods of propaganda. Edward Albee's new play Listening is an example. In the radio version, designed apparently for transfer to the stage, the play's only physical action, aside from the entrance of the play's three characters, is that of a character who slashes her wrists because no one will listen to her. The message is the evil of manipulation, and to express it, Albee purposely manipulates his audience, frustrating its reasonable wish to know who the characters are, whether they're alive or dead, where they've met, and what it is that they're talking about. Thus, he preaches the evils of manipulation not by drama, but by insult and coercion, techniques more appropriate to the tyrant than to the artist, allowing himself only minimal use of plot, character, or even intellectual argument, and choosing to make very little use of setting. Albee depends almost entirely on random-sounding sentences. Odd and innovative as it may seem at first glance, the play is thus typical of present theatrical art. All texture. Texture is our refuge, the one thing we know we're good at. This is perhaps one reason ballet is now the healthiest of the arts. Here, a failure of surface means total failure, as it does not in fiction, symphonic music, or even painting. So the overemphasis on texture and the manipulation of the structure all falls under control of a message that the artist wants to deliver at the outset. Now, that's a problem, right? That message is increasingly nihilistic in John Gardner's time, and I would say that there are some sort of byproducts of nihilism that we're seeing today, right? The message is nihilistic and the consequence of the guilt of being fallible humans, right? We covered that in part 3 of the series, the idea that a new sort of guilt flooded in to replace biblical guilt once we decided that the Bible was oppressive and no longer a thing to pay attention to, right? Now, so this new guilt, because you can't get away from guilt, right, is the guilt of always falling short of accomplishing anything real because of how much we inherently suck, right? So Gardner says, these postmodernists will gladly let Little Red Riding Hood get eaten by the wolf, and not even because they have empathy for the hungry wolf. Now that's interesting, right? Because what is the morality of Little Red Riding Hood? Right? Initially, as far as we know, right, it was a cautionary tale. And indeed, Little Red Riding Hood gets eaten at the end of the story along with her grandmother, right? Just a lovely story, right? So what was the morality of that? Right. Where's the morality of something like Little Red Riding Hood? Well, for starters, how about do not stray from the path that was intended for you? Now that's a fairly conservative outlook, but it's about acknowledging and facing your responsibilities in a forthright manner, right? Don't stray from that path that was intended from you, what you were instructed to do, right? Also, heed the wisdom of your elders. And a lot of fables have that. Right? Heed the wisdom of your elders. Little Red's mother, right, warns her not to stray from the path that was intended for her, but she doesn't listen. And she gets distracted. Her own ambition motivates her to get off the path and sweeten the pot of her gift basket. So her mother's wisdom goes by the wayside, right? She becomes convinced by the wolf, when the wolf encounters her in the woods, that she can make her gift for grandma even better if she picks some flowers that are off the path, right? So her ambition to try to make an even sweeter gift for her grandmother sends her off the path that she was supposed to be, takes her away from her responsibilities, which leads us to another moral, right? Be careful of false prophets. Or people who disguise themselves as friends when they're really enemies, right? And to safeguard from this, you need to recycle the previous two morals. Stay on the path, listen to your elders, right? The previous two morals that we get from that story. Now, as the tale evolved over the next century, since its inception, right, it added something to mull over, and this was Christianity's influence, right? Because the tale of Little Red Riding Hood actually predates Christianity, at least in European Christianity, right? And it adds something, right? It adds the power of redemption to the story, right? So Christianity's influence over the story is that it adds this idea of the redemption arc, right? Now that's important, right? This is where Gardner kind of picks at nihilistic fiction, which probably would have left things the way they were, would have just left Little Red Riding Hood eaten and the grandma eaten, right? The nihilists, but Christianity's influence is there nonetheless, right? The morals we just discussed about Little Red Riding Hood cannot be reinforced without giving her another chance to show how she's grown from the experience, right? And that's the importance of the addendum to that story, right? The addition of that redemption, right? The tale was better suited for the 17th century, right? When the Brothers Grimm reached back to grab the lesson that they got from Jonah and the Big Fish, right? So there's this Christian influence that is brought to Little Red Riding Hood courtesy of Jonah and the Big Fish. In the Book of Jonah, right, after refusing a similar instruction from his heavenly father, right, instead of Little Red Riding Hood's mother, Jonah gets his instruction from his heavenly father. Jonah gets on a boat to escape his responsibility, right, to get off of the path. A storm threatens to destroy the ship, kill everyone on board. Jonah recognizes that he's the reason the ship is in danger and instructs the crew to cast him overboard. And that's when he's swallowed by a behemoth, a whale, or perhaps a large shark, We're not entirely sure. So Jonah survives in the belly of the fish for 3 days until finally he gets vomited up onto a beach. Which is an important part of the story because that's where he gets that chance to make right what he did wrong, right? And so does Little Red Riding Hood in the later versions of the story, right? Both versions are moral, which is an important thing to think about, right? The pre-Christian version is moral as well as the Christian version. So what Gardner's really saying after, or what he's really trying to get at, is that the idea that contemporary writers would be caught in the particulars of the story, the fact, for example, that a man has to come rescue Little Red Riding Hood as a reinforcement of the patriarchy, right? Again, focusing on what is versus what ought to be, right? That's what contemporary writers and contemporary critics would get hung up on as far as the moral of Little Red Riding Hood, right? Other writers would put forth the absurdity of trying to do anything, right? Please the grandmother, inquire about someone who you trust, grandma, what's with your nose, what's with your eyes, what's wrong with your teeth, right? And ultimately, life ends in brutal fashion, and that's that, right? That is the sort of nihilistic slash absurdist viewpoint of what we're supposed to take away from Little Red Riding Hood, right? We're not really supposed to take anything away from it except for any attempt to change your situation as human beings is always going to fail because of the guilt of human fallibility, right? But two things have to happen for moral art in Little Red Riding Hood. There's two important things that need to be there. Number one, Little Red Riding Hood has to leave her mother's house, embark on her own journey. And number two, she has to be eaten, right? Can she stay eaten? Yes, but that tells a different story than no, right? But the point is that she has to be eaten, right? John Gardner says, when he talks about looking at fiction as pure language, over in the same chapter on page 69, he says, fiction as pure language, texture of a structure is in, right? Meaning it's hip, right? It is one common manifestation of what is being called postmodernism. At bottom, the mistake is a matter of morality, at least in the sense that it shows, on the writer's part, a lack of concern to people who care about events and ideas, and thus necessarily about the clear and efficient statement of both. Linguistic opacity suggests indifference to the needs and wishes of the reader, and to whatever ideas may be buried under all that brush. And since one reason we read fiction is our hope that we'll be moved by it, finding characters we can enjoy and sympathize with, an academic striving for opacity suggests, if not misanthropy, a perversity or shallowness that no reader would tolerate except if he's one of these poor, milquetoast innocents who timidly accept violation of their feelings from a habit of supposing they must be missing something. Or one of these arrogant donzels who chuckle at things obscure because their enjoyment proves to them that they are not like lesser mortals. Where language is of primary concern to the writer, communication is necessarily secondary. Right? So language-only fiction sort of violates the reader, violates the trust of the reader, and challenges the reader to almost pretend as if they don't understand or pretend that they do understand because they're smarter than the rest of us. No one enjoys feeling left out of a story's effect, and obscure language shows a certain antipathy or contempt for the reader. And the only people pretending to understand and enjoy the obscurity are doing so to prove how highly intelligent they are to compare to the rest of us. Think about Franzen. Think David Foster Wallace, right? It's linguistic sculpture, as Gardner puts it, right? And he finishes quite strongly with this idea, right? Now, I know some of you might love Franzen, and some of you might love David Foster Wallace. I can't make head or tail of them. Right? When I read that passage from John Gardner, maybe you have writers that you think about when you read that passage. Those are the two writers I think about because they are hailed as literary lions, and I can't even get through them. I just can't. He finishes pretty strongly here. Where he says, he talks about beautiful writing, right? and sort of the allure and the seduction of beautiful writing. But that it has to go above, you know, it has to go further than that, right? It says mobs of contemporary writers, right? Mobs of contemporary writers refers to them as, right? So this was something that was not just a product of one or two people, right? Mobs of contemporary writers, writers very different in other respects, follow Gass in focusing their attention on language, gathering nouns and verbs the way a crow collects paperclips, sending off their characters and action to take a long nap. J.P. Dunleavy, Ron Suchnick, James Purdy, Stanley Elkin, John Barth, and a good many more of our writers concentrate to a greater or lesser extent on language for its own sake, more in love on principle with the sound of words or with newfangledness than the creating fictional worlds. One might say in their defense that what they create is linguistic sculpture, or one might argue that some of this tightly wedged cocklebird fiction goes beautifully, like Finnegan's Wake, when read aloud. Even about Wake, one may, of course, have reservations, but the fact remains that the search for opacity has little to do with the age-old search for understanding and affirmation. Linguistic sculpture, at best, makes only the affirmation sandcastles make, that it is pleasant to make things or look at things made, better to be alive than dead. The more time one spends piling up words, the less often one needs to move from point to point, argument to argument, or event to event. That is, the less need one has of structure. Many people now working at serious literature do not move in neat, episodic form from point to point. Notably, the so-called moderns, sometimes called writers of the quote-unquote liberal tradition. That is, writers concerned with discovering and passing on the values of a free society. And it is natural to expect of these writers a greater engagement with life's burning issues. But on the whole, we discover even writers who profess a concern about truth do not often take the trouble to search out real understanding or dramatically earn their assertions. The modernist truth tend to be not responsible and judicious, but just fashionable. Instead of the decadence of texture without structure, the enfeebled modernist offers structure independent of and indifferent to texture. Often, for example, the fiction's characters have no effect on the plot because the writer is all but unaware of their existence. Though they wail and howl and take cyanide, their creator, like the god of the Calvinists, loves only his ideas. Universals run roughshod over the particulars they require for validation. This decadence is in a way even less to be admired than the decadence of opaque language. Instead of saying nothing, it says with speciously dramatic effect, fashionable things that are not so. Fashionable things that are not so. It's a fantastic way to sum up what he's saying here in chapter 4, and I think that's probably a good place to leave it. That's the end of chapter 4. We'll start to look forward into chapter 5. When we get into which is the last part of the first half of the book. That's the last chapter to think about. Fashionable things that aren't so. So where do we move on from there? Thanks for taking the time to listen to this. We will take a look at chapter 5 in the next installment, right? And that is the final chapter of part 1. And we'll be looking at that in my next episode. I'm Matthew McGevna. You're listening to The Ink Drop, and you take care. Call me like a hell. Hellcat.